Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Sometimes people say to me, Pastor Jeff, how do you know there's a God? And I say it's simple math. God either exists or he doesn't. So let's be cynical. Worst case scenario, there's a 50-50 chance. And I like those odds.
That's wrong.
Shelley, put your hand down. Sorry, please continue.
It's okay, Mary. It's Sheldon, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, Sheldon, why don't you come on up here and tell me how I'm wrong?
No.
Okay.
Let's give him a hand, everybody.
What's happening? Shelly's going to eat him alive.
So, you were saying?
You've confused possibilities with probabilities. According to your analogy, when I go home, I might find $1 million on my bed, or I might not. In what universe is that 50-50?
So, what do you think the odds are that God exists?
I think they're zero. I believe in science.
So, you don't think science and religion can go hand in hand?
Science is facts. Religion is faith. I prefer facts.
Mm-hmm. Let's give it up for Sheldon, everybody. What a good sport.
I watched TV shows like that, and every time it seems like the preacher is made out to be this absolute buffoon, which I'm not sure whether to be troubled by that, humbled by that. I kind of wonder, is that how people see me when I'm up there? I don't know. I just have to take it, you know, that's what it is. And Sheldon brings up this thing. It comes up quite a bit, and he's sort of used in this mode of communication to communicate something that is often said or thought or taught or believed out there, that science is about facts, that religion is about faith. And that's something I don't agree with that really at all, as a matter of fact. I say a lot of faith in science. Actually, that's what most of science is faith. And there's a lot of facts when it comes to what I believe. I mentioned last week that faith is what I believe to be true based on what I know to be true, based on what I observe. It's not just blind faith, if you will. And so I think there's an issue there that comes up, and we're going to be looking at it a little bit more this morning. And so whenever we're basically in this series, we're talking about things, how can you be sure of these things? Because Hebrews chapter 11 says, now faith is being sure of what you hope for with the evidence of things not seen. And when it comes to the three great questions of life, I need something more than just a blind hope on it. When it comes to the questions of how did I get here, why am I here, and what happens after I die, I want to know what is the evidentiary proof that can give me some formulated idea to have some faith of what I can believe in, what I can put my trust in, what is really real, that I can have some surety about these things of great uncertainty. And so last week we talked about how what Easter did for humanity was give us some sense of evidentiary proof and certainty about what happens after we die. For this world has witnessed a human being come to earth, live a life, die on a cross, be buried in a tomb, and 3 days later come out of the grave just as he said he would, to prove once and for all there really is life after death, that I can know that there is life after death because of what Jesus Christ has modeled and showed and demonstrated for us. So I believe there's life after death because of evidentiary proof of life after death. So what about origins? What can be known about origins, where we came from? It's interesting. In that clip, young Sheldon goes home and he vows he's going to come back and destroy that moronic preacher. And sure enough, where he goes next is to the issue of origins. I didn't really have time to put all of the stuff in there about that. And he kind of rips him apart when it comes to origins. But I'll just begin with his opening statement that religion is about faith and that science is about fact. That's kind of what I want to go through this morning. Now, in doing that, I'm going to go through some of the scriptural texts. And by the way, the best thing about coming to the late service is you're going to get the entire message. Every other service, they get the abbreviated version. If you got to be somewhere, that's okay. The back doors are just fine. That one right there is like a nightclub entrance. It'll exit you right out to the street, but you can't get back in. That's okay. I won't be offended. You can leave anytime you want. But I got to get through it because there's just too much good stuff here for it. So we're going to be going through a little bit of the Bible text, but also going through some of the other things that are out there. And I really struggle with a message like this, because on the one hand, if I spend the entire time in the scriptures, then those of you who come from the science world are going to look at me and say, you can't prove anything about the science world or say anything about the science world, just tell me what the Bible says. On the other hand, if I spend my entire morning talking about what the scientific community says about our origins, then some of you are going to look back at me and say, I came to church to hear something from the Bible, not just about what the scientific community says. And so I really can't win on this. So to begin with, I'm going to tell you, I put some references up there. Genesis 1 and 2, Job 37 to 39, Psalm 104, and Proverbs chapter 8. All have creation narratives in them. Oftentimes, we only think of Genesis 1 and 2 as the only creation narrative. However, there's several creation narratives in the Bible. There's also several other, too many to mention, statements about our origins or about creation or about God's hand in creation throughout the Bible. Way too many to list. I just put on there the ones that actually have sort of a narrative explanative passage on it. And then last thing I'm going to say about the Bible is, the Bible's goal is not to be a scientific account. Many years back when I was talking about what the Bible is and what it isn't, you can't look at a piece of literature and try to interpret it as if it was a different kind of literature. Often said that if you read Webster's Dictionary, looking for Webster's Dictionary to be a biography about Webster's life, you're going to be very frustrated and mistaken. It is a dictionary. It has nothing to do with Webster other than the fact that he was one of the original guys who compiled these lists of definitions. It is not a narrative. It is not a biography. It is a reference book. And if you look to the Bible to be a scientific textbook, it is not. It is a historical account about God's relationship with humanity. And along the way, there are some things in there that line up with science and happen to converge with the scientific community. There's a lot of other things in there that really have nothing to do with science because it's about our relationship with God. Now, that's not to say that one is more or less accurate. They're just different kinds of pieces of literature. I just got to begin with that. So from there, I want to begin over in the book of Romans to be able to talk about Sheldon's comment about science is fact, religion is faith. In Romans chapter 1, verses 18, it says that the wrath of God is being revealed against all humanity and godliness or godlessness and wickedness. Of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God's made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal powers, divine nature, have been clearly seen and understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him nor gave thanks for him, but their thinking became futile, their hearts became foolish and darkened, and though they claimed to be wise, they began to talk and become fools. So a couple things in here that are sort of statements that are made here. One is there is a concerted effort to suppress the truth. And the question I guess I want to pose is, was that just something that happened 2,000 years ago, or is there still a concerted effort to suppress truth? Second question I want to ask is there enough about God? Is there enough evidentiary proof from creation or from our origins to point to there being a creator God? Now, Bertrand Russell was famously known for saying, if you were to meet God face to face and there really is a God, what would you say to him? I would say, sir, why did you not give us enough proof? And I'm going to give you an explanation as to why Bertrand Russell could not find proof. And it has to do with our understanding of science. Now, to begin, when I talk about science and all these different terms, as I have a marketing background, and I spent all my undergrad time at Florida State University looking into marketing. How can we better sell products? And one of the interesting tricks about marketing is what we put on the product label, because we know that you will make decisions spur of the moment what you will buy, what you will not buy, based on how the package looks and what the package says. And so there is an incentive for marketers to mislead you with their labels. And now that the internet is out there, a lot of marketers are getting sort of caught in doing this. There was an article in health.com in June 2012 titled, "The 16 Most Misleading Food Labels." Amongst them were things like all natural. When you read all natural, what do you think? This is all natural. They didn't put anything in this. Well, legally, all natural only means that there are no artificial flavorings or artificial colors in it. There can be as much corn syrup as you possibly want to inject into the thing. You can put corn syrup into just about anything out there. You can put corn syrup inside your orange, and it doesn't matter. They can sweeten the thing up that way, but it's still all natural. You wouldn't think it's all natural, but they can say it's all natural. My favorite one is free-range chicken. How many of y'all would prefer to have a free-range chicken lay your egg and a free-range chicken be what you serve? Anybody? Okay. Do you know what the definition legally is of free-range? It means that at some point in that chicken's life, it was able to go outside. Now, that's not at all what I think when I think of free-range chicken. I really think of, you know, I picture Julie Andrews out there, Sound of Music, running around with all the chickens that are on my table. You know, these chickens have had a good life. Now, of course, ultimately, they're going to meet their demise and end up on my table. Ultimately, they're going to be producing eggs for my benefit. But, you know, at least these chickens will have had a good life. They won't be all cooped up literally in a pen of disease and everything else that goes on inside that chicken coop. They'll live a good life while they're alive, and they'll have a free life out in the oxygen, out to get there with nature. That's what I picture and think when I think of free-range eggs. All it simply means is that chicken, if that chicken lived 100 years, or sorry, that chicken lived 100 days. For one day, the farmer, if he takes him outside the chicken hoop, has him do one lap around the chicken coop, then puts them all right back in, it is now a free-range chicken. And that's exactly what you were picturing, right? No, not at all. I would say if you really want a free-range chicken egg, find one of the farmers in our church who actually have real free-range chickens and ask them if you can buy a dozen eggs. They'll usually sell them for your $2, $3, $4 a dozen. A lot better than whatever you'll find over in the grocery store. My last favorite one is made with real fruit or made with real fruit juice. Did you know that legally the fruit juice doesn't even have to be the kind of fruit that the product's advertising? There was a very famous lawsuit with fruit roll-ups that, because strawberry-flavored fruit roll-ups didn't have any strawberry fruit in them. They had a different kind of fruit in them. But hey, made with real fruit juice. We didn't say what kind of fruit juice. We just said made with real fruit juice. I found this to be true with the iced tea that I like. I like drinking iced tea lemonade. One of my favorite brands of iced tea lemonade, I looked on the back, the fruit juice that's in it is not lemons. It's apple juice. And now every time I drink it, all I think to myself is I'm drinking iced tea apple juice. But that doesn't sound very appealing now, does it? Iced tea lemonade sounds a lot better. They put a bunch of artificial flavoring in it to make it taste a little bit more lemony, but now all I can taste in it when I drink it is apple juice because that's what's actually in the product. Now, all of that, would you say, is very deceptive? Yeah, because I've made a statement, and I know full well what you thought when you read that statement, but legally over here or somewhere that you don't know about, I've redefined the term. And that's exactly what you have when you read science is fact, religion is faith, evolution is a fact. We'll begin with science. When you were in science class somewhere in elementary school or middle school, maybe even high school, you probably had a definition of science that was something like this. Science is a systematic knowledge of the physical or material world gained through observation and experimentation that can be replicated. So a scientific thought or scientific fact would be a systematic knowledge of the physical or material world that was gained through observation and experimentation that can be replicated. Now, that's what we think of when we think about science. So science has to do with observing evidence that points to a conclusion. Now, when we think about evidence, we often think about evidence as something that everybody would draw the same conclusion to, scientifically. But we know that's not true in most other areas of life. For instance, O.J. was found not guilty. Bill Cosby had a hung trial. Now, how on earth could a jury of peers look at the evidence of O.J., because now we know if he did it, how he would have done it. We watch that series and you think to yourself, how on earth could 12 people not be convinced this guy is guilty? And then with everything you have heard or read about Bill Cosby, you wonder yourself, how could a jury not be able to make up their mind about some sense of guilt in this case, and yet there was somebody who was unconvinced by the evidence in that case? How does that happen? Could it be that maybe, just maybe, somebody was influenced in the way that they interpreted the evidence based on a preconceived philosophy or notion or belief about that person? I mean, all I ever knew of O.J., I didn't know O.J. of his football days. I knew O.J. from Naked Gun. He was Nuremberg, right? Remember, the police detective? I knew him from the Hertz commercials. I knew him as a sideline reporter. He's a good guy, a lovable guy. And you think to yourself, how could this guy do something like that? It wasn't the O.J. of the O.J. interview that I was thinking of. I'm thinking of the O.J. back in the 80s. That's the O.J. I knew. And Bill Cosby. I mean, come on, Pudding Pops? He was America's father, right? How many of y'all grew up hoping to be a dad like Bill Cosby? How many of y'all wanted to raise your kids like Bill Cosby was raising his kids in The Cosby Show? It was like the best sitcom for some of y'all are like, I don't really know how I feel about that now. If you can just go back to the Wayback Machine of the 80s, you felt very differently about it. Do you think it's possible that the evidence in those cases was at all impacted by what their philosophy or viewpoint was going into those cases. Anybody? Yes, absolutely. Does that happen in science? Absolutely. So much so that they even talk about how that influences scientific thought and interpretation. One of the great quotes was that Darwinism did not just impact how we view living things, but it impacted the nature of science itself. Because out of Darwinism came the idea of naturalism, or at least naturalism now had a new platform in Darwinism. Naturalism is simply the viewpoint, the philosophical viewpoint, that is, that begins with the premise that everything arises from natural properties and causes, that nature is all there is, and that nature is essentially unmodified by anything else other than itself. This was restated at the beginning of Carl Sagan's series, The Cosmos, that the cosmos is all there ever is and all there ever was, and everything that came into being through the cosmos. In other words, there was no outside force that acted upon it. And so here's what happens. Anything that points to some other evidentiary proof outside of nature is discounted now in science. So if anything points to an intelligent design of something, that is not considered science because we're only focused on what could naturally occur. And on the surface, that sounds good because as one scholar put it, once I go into the realm of God did it, I no longer can perform an experiment on that, which I disagree with, by the way. However, simply whenever something points toward intelligent design, they now declassify that as being scientific. Now, this can lead to some pretty absurd conclusions. I'm going to take it to its extreme just so I can show you the absurdity of it. If you were walking along Sandbridge Beach and you saw this on the beach as you were walking along, what would you conclude? What? Somebody put it there. First service was my favorite. Somebody said, somebody was thinking of me. So we don't have a naturalist, we have a narcissist. But now, if you were to go and explore this scientifically as a scientist, you would not conclude it was written by a person because that would presuppose intelligent design. That would presuppose that something other than a natural mechanism left what it is that you see. Rather, you would begin to explore, could the waves have crashed upon the beach in such a way that they left this emblem? Now, I know there is a symbol here, and I know that there are letters inside that symbol who are perfectly arranged in a sentence structure. The meaning of that sentence structure coincides with the symbol that is around it. However, that's got to be a coincidence. That's got to be something that naturally occurred to have that happen. Could it be, perhaps, because we know there are several animals, shellfish, that live in the sea that make beautiful designs on the ocean floor, could it be that one of those, maybe the tide was higher and left this imprint, and as the tide moved away, it left this imprint? Could it be? Could it be that an animal perhaps was chasing another animal in that exact pattern and just so happened to look to us to be communicating this language? Perhaps, maybe. Now, you might say those conclusions are absolutely absurd. You might say the most logical conclusion is that an intelligent being came along and was thinking of somebody and wrote, I love you. But who are you to infer that intelligent design happened? That is not a scientific answer. We're only considering scientific possibilities for how this could have existed. So, once you move science and blend it with the philosophy of naturalism, you no longer have the kind of science you grew up with. You now have a science which is constrained and confined by a philosophy of naturalism, which by its very nature is going to exclude certain pieces of information. For instance, when you look at this as a simple probability, Sheldon was talking about possibility versus probability. Very interesting that he would bring that up in this discussion. The possibility that life just accidentally happened. That's interesting. Could life have just accidentally happened? I guess it's possible. What's the probability on that? It's been estimated that it's around 1 to 10 to the 130th power. In other words, one, you have a chance in one, and then just put one with 130 different zeros after that. Just picture those odds. Now, your chance at winning the lottery is 1 in 23 million, okay? So if you're only going to go by naturalistic means, if you won the lottery, you would have beaten the odds and had a 1 in 23 million chance. Let's just say you won the lottery this week, and then you use the exact same numbers and you won it next week, then you use the exact same numbers and won it the third week in a row. Do you think anybody might question your results? Do you think the lottery commission might be a little bit hesitant to give you your money? What do you think the lottery commission might conclude? You cheated. That, in other words, somehow your intelligent scheming interacted to rig the system so that you could win 3 times in a row. By the way, the probability that you would win the lottery 10 times in a row with the exact same numbers is far more likely statistically than that the universe formed itself, created living beings, and those living beings then mutated into other living beings to have the earth that you now have. Far more likely. And yet, with lottery, instantly you're saying rigged. And with creation, we've got to say, nope, definitely not rigged, definitely not an intelligent designer. There's probably some other force that could have naturally acted on that. That's exactly where the scientists go. George Wald, now this quote bothers me more than anything else. The guy's from Harvard. And the reason why that bothers me is because Harvard would never allow me in. Yet this guy gets to teach there. Let me read you his quote. One only has to contemplate the magnitude of the task to concede that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. In other words, probability, impossible. It doesn't even fall within the realm of probability. It's so far beyond probable that it is in the realm of impossibility. That's what those numbers we were talking about a minute ago. Yet, here we are. And as a result, I believe in spontaneous generation. Wait a minute, Sheldon. Didn't you say science was fact? And here this guy is talking about how it is that we ended up here, and we think that science is all about science, and this guy is saying, I what? I believe in spontaneous generation? That doesn't sound like fact to me. That sounds like the realm of faith, and not just intelligent faith, not just informed faith, but rather blind faith. Here we are, so it must have happened. So what exactly is our faith in? He goes on. The important point to note here is that since the origin of life belongs to a category of at least one-time phenomenon. In other words, this only had to happen once. So I find that to be in our favor. It didn't happen to have to happen twice in 1 in 10 to the 130 zeros. It only happened to have once in 10 to the 130 zeros. So he says it only had to happen once. And once it happened once, we believe there's a capacity for growth and reproduction to occur. He says time, in fact, then is the hero of the plot. The time which we have to deal with is in the order of at least 2 billion years. So what we might regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. And the possible becomes probable. And the probable becomes virtually certain. One only has to wait because time itself performs the miracle. Miracle? Wait a minute. I thought that miracles were only things we talked about in the realm of religion and in faith, and the things that Jesus did, the things the apostles did, the things that happened with Moses in the Red Sea. I thought the parting of the Red Sea was a miracle. Are you telling me there was something involved in your theory that is a miracle? What's your faith in to perform this miracle? Anybody? Time. Time becomes the hero. Time becomes where our faith is placed. So just keep this in mind. We have to have time for this theory and idea to work. Just put that on the front end. So whatever we do with the data, if it doesn't give us the right time frame, it must not therefore be correct because the natural process requires a whole lot of time. Moving on. Arthur Edgington said it like this: we must allow evolution to have an infinite amount of time to get started. Why do we need an infinite amount of time? Not just 2 billion years, but an infinite amount of time. Because if you give it enough time, as unlikely as it may be, if you are 1 in 10 to the 130 zeros probability, what if you have 1 in 10 to the 16,000 zeros worth of time? Certainly it would have happened at least once in that time frame, right? Because of all the time and chances that we have. Well, this was an idea that went along for a long time, and the problem with this idea was that around that time, they believed in the steady state theory. That was the original belief about the universe. In other words, the idea was that the universe always was. It did not have a finite time. It did not begin at a certain time. It just always was, and therefore there was an infinite amount of time for these processes to have happened and to have occurred. Well, back in the late 50s, on into the 70s, we began to start to notice that it seemed as though these stars were moving outward in a way. It's often known as a redshift or from background microwave radiation. One of the guys who discovered this was a guy named Arno Pinzas. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. He won the Nobel Prize for this back in 1978. And he says this: the best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the 5 books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. Now, have you ever in your lifetime heard that the Big Bang Theory is proving Scripture? No, it was always told to me, there's this dumb scriptural idea out there of blind faith, but the science is telling us it came from the Big Bang. Do you realize when the Big Bang first came out, it rocked the scientific world until they could repackage the information in some way to continue to diss the church? Originally, the scientists who found it said, oh my goodness, those creationists have been all right all along. The universe did have a beginning time. It did have a start point. God did create out of nothing. And where does that leave us? Well, another guy comes along. I've cut out a couple of other quotes. Well, this one's from Richard Dawkins. He was over, I think, Cambridge or Oxford, one of those over in Europe. Very well-known atheist. He said, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So, I'll admit, the evidentiary proof gives the appearance that there was intelligent design behind it. However, science does not allow for intelligent design, so although it has the appearance of design, we cannot allow for that to be our conclusion. And what does he do in this book called The Blind Watchmaker? He goes on to give a bunch of hypothetical, superstitious, imaginative ideas for how we got the world that we have. Even though it looks like it's appeared to be designed, it really isn't. Another great quote on this one is Francis Crick. He's the one who was a part of the discovery of DNA. He said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Did you get that? I know when you look at the evidence, it's going to point you to start thinking that all this stuff was designed. But remember now, we've already determined that science does not deal with anything that was intelligent design. We have to keep it over in the realm of evolved. So if it does not point to evolution, throw it out. Just keep your mind focused. You're looking for evolution, nothing else. Does that seem like you're just looking for blind facts? Does that seem like the science that you had when you were in middle school and in high school? When you think about science, do you think about somebody who's going to throw away any evidence that does not lead to your conclusion? It's not what I think. I would call this free-range facts, free-range science, free-range belief, free-range philosophy. It sounds a lot more like a faith statement to me than it does about something that's based in facts. Facts, that's an interesting word. Let's go to facts. When you think about the word fact, fact would be a truth known by actual experience or observation of a repeatable and measurable event. It's a fact, right? Isn't that what you think of when you think of fact? It's something that's known by actual experience or observation of a repeatable, measurable event. So to get to a fact along the scientific method, you first start with a hypothesis. You've noticed a few things, you observe a few things, and you say, you know, I think this is what's causing that. That's a hypothesis. So then you run some observable, repeatable tests that would sort of, you know, help clarify this hypothesis. And if the repeatable, observable tests that you are performing continue to fall in line with your hypothesis, eventually you move to saying, this is my theory, because I've got some observable, evidentiary things that seem to support this. Now, when it comes to theories, Stephen Hawking says, let's remind ourselves that all theories are provisional because we must acknowledge that there are some things we may not know. For instance, where he's going with this was Isaac Newton had his theories about our laws of motion and gravity, and those stood for 300 years. Then along came Einstein and said, well, what about the theory of relativity? And he basically blew apart all the Newtonian physics that stood for 300 years. And in one of his journals, he even writes an apology to Isaac Newton, sort of theoretically, saying, I want to apologize to Isaac Newton. It's not that he was dumb or misled. He was the most brilliant man who came to the logical conclusion based on the evidence that he had available to him 300 years ago. But now, here's what we know. And so he basically is saying that he wasn't that he was dumb, he just didn't have all the information. And so Hawking is looking at this kind of stuff and says, you know, even if we have a theory that we're pretty sure of, we still have to admit there may be things we don't know about it. And so that's why it always stays in the realm of theory, and nothing ever gets to the realm of fact unless it is absolutely repeatable 100 times over. And even then, there may be still some room for question as to whether or not that really is, unless it's just like something like you are 6 feet tall, and we use a measurement to determine 6 feet tall. Move on. So that's what fact was, and that's what you think of when you think of facts. However, science has now altered the definition of fact without telling you. Hermann Joseph Müller says this in 1953. There's no sharp line now between speculation, hypothesis, theory, principle, and fact. Only a difference along a sliding scale in the degree of probability of the idea. So when we say something is a fact, we only mean that its probability is an extremely high one. So high that we're not bothered by any doubt about it and are ready to act accordingly. So now in the use of the term fact, the only proper one is evolution is a fact. Oh, see, when you said evolution was a fact, I thought you were referring to a measurable, repeatable event that has happened over and over and over again that you could define. I didn't realize you were using a sliding scale somewhere between an hypothesis and fact, which basically only means that you no longer doubt it. So let me get this straight. If you no longer doubt a conclusion, it's now a fact. Did you know it's a fact that I'm the world's greatest preacher? I have no doubt. Now, do you agree with my fact finding? No, don't answer that. Okay, so, but by the scientific definition of fact, I could make that claim simply because I think there's a really high probability of that, and I no longer have any doubts. And if I get enough people together with me, together we can conclude it is now fact, even though it is not measurable, repeatable, any of the typical definitions that we think of when you think of facts. Once again, we now have what I would call free-range facts. We have all natural facts. We have made with all natural facts. And you think it's one thing, but the scientific community is really saying something else. So when Sheldon says science is about facts, what is he really saying? He's basically saying that chicken is free range. Religion is all about faith. We don't use faith. We use facts. We have a sliding scale about facts. We have a very loose definition of what you consider to be science. Let's go to evolution anyway. So when it comes to evolution, I've heard many people tell me that science is now an indisputable fact. Well, when they're talking about evolution, when you think of evolution, what do you think of? You think of the classic, typical, there was a single cell something or other. That single cell something became into a multiple cell something. That multiple cell something was probably swimming somewhere in some body of water. It got bigger and bigger. Eventually, there was something that grew legs. Gradually, over time, then it took wings. And gradually, over time, it became a monkey. And gradually, over time, it became you. That's pretty much the theory of evolution, right? Well, within the theory of evolution, there's what's known as microevolution and macroevolution. What I just described to you was macroevolution. Now, we have not been able to repeat and observe the process of macroevolution. We don't have any evidentiary proof of it. What we do see, however, is microevolution. Now, microevolution are things like the natural selection, the survival of the fittest. For instance, if there were a beetle that had both an orange variation and a yellow variation, and all the flowers in that particular part of the world were all yellow, what ends up happening is the birds pretty easily pick off all the orange beetles, so pretty soon those get bred out of the population, so the only beetle that is left is the yellow beetle. And so therefore, natural selection has led to the elimination of the orange beetle and now favored the yellow beetle, and that is how that trait was picked up and moved on. There's also what's known as adaptation. This is something that my body is currently experiencing right now. On Extravaganza. It was quite sunny out. I no longer have any hair on the top of my head, and I came home with a sunburn on my head and a pretty red neck. Now, over the past couple weeks, it has begun to peel off, and what is left is a really nice golden brown that is developing. And over the summer, my neck and my head are going to get more and more brown. Now, if I take off my shirt, you're going to be blinded by the whiteness of my back. However, what is exposed to sun is becoming more and more brown, which allows my body to adapt to the changing conditions, so therefore, over the course of the summer, I'm not as likely to get a sunburn. That's an adaptation. So the idea and the theory is, given enough time, these kind of natural selections and adaptations over time will allow one species to morph into another species. That's the idea. So it's the microevolution that we can observe and prove is taken to the what they believe is a logical step to macroevolution. Well, the problem with this is the fossil record is going completely against this. The evidentiary proof is going completely against this. Georgia Tech geneticists writes an article called The Darwinian Paradox, a guy named John McDonald. He says, genes that vary within natural populations only affect the minor aspects of form and function, coloration, wing length, beak length, things like that. He says, while genes that govern major changes, like changes between species or improvements, the very stuff of macroevolution apparently do not vary, or if they do vary, vary to the detriment of the organism. In other words, no parent ever wants to hear your child has a mutation. You don't sit in the waiting room and go, does he have wings? Now, I know that was a very crass, very insensitive thing to say, but that's a reality of it, that mutations don't lead to beneficial changes in any species anywhere that's ever been studied. In other words, we're not seeing any evidentiary or genetic proof of macroevolution. The fossil record does not show macroevolution. As a matter of fact, what you would expect the fossil record to show is a gradual change of species with intermediary forms all along the way. We have no intermediary forms. And second of all, what the fossil record shows is a stagnation and then all of a sudden an explosion of creation, an explosion of species development. I was watching one video on this, and the narrator says, "The wheels of evolution sped up for a unique period of time as the species proliferated across the Earth." I had two problems with that. One is that goes completely against what I was always told about evolution. Remember, evolution, the hero is natural slow changes over time. And now you're telling me the evidentiary proof is this explosion where the wheels of evolution sped up rather rapidly. The other problem I had was, I've heard that somewhere else, that there was a proliferation of various kinds of species, each according to their kind, that all of a sudden came onto the scene very rapidly and quickly. Where have I heard that or read that? Oh, in Genesis. So you're right. It was in Genesis, wasn't it? And there's no acknowledgement to the connection of the fact. Why? Because that's not science. We discount anything that deals with intelligent design. We're only looking at natural means, and our natural means is not giving us the conclusion that we want. So we just gloss over it and say, well, the wheels of evolution must have sped up for that period of time. It must have been very unique, very interesting. Moving on. So if we now have redefined the word science and told you science and you don't quite understand our definition, we've now redefined the word fact, but without you knowing it, that we've changed it to a sliding scale, and we've also redefined the word evolution so that you think macroevolution, we're talking about what's been proven is microevolution, and don't literally make the distinction, and you wonder why it is you don't believe what I believe, or wonder why it is you have a doubt, and I come at you and I say evolution has been proven. No, it hasn't. If anything, macroevolution continues to be disproven, but we throw out all the evidentiary proof of that. So why is it, or is there any evidentiary proof about what I believe in the Bible? Is Sheldon right in saying that the religion is all about faith, science is about fact? Well, now I know much about your facts. I'll tell you some of my actual facts that are in line with what you would actually believe or think of in the traditional terms of facts that have to do with the Bible. One is what Michael Behe would call in his book, Darwin's Black Box, back in 1996. He said, there is an irreducible complexity to the cellular structure. In other words, what he means by that is the whole idea of evolution is that you had a single cell, which then created a two-cell, three-cell, that organism went from very simple to very complex over a gradual process. He says the problem is that can't happen gradually. It would have to happen in a one-step jump, because for a cell to go from a single cell to a complex cell, what you have is you have six or seven inner working parts that all have to be present, all appear at the exact same time and in the right order and in the right placement. And for that to happen, that's not going to happen natural. It'd be like saying that all of a sudden, he uses a mousetrap illustration. Picture all of the parts of a mousetrap. You have a platform, you have a spring, you have a hammer, and you have bait. All of those things would have to appear at the exact same time and in the right order in order for you to be able to catch a mouse. If you had the spring without the hammer, you don't catch fewer mice, you catch no mice. If you have the spring and the hammer but no platform to put it on, it's not going to be able to have anything to whack against, you catch no mice. Everything has to form at the exact right time in the exact right order to have anything. You can't gradually get a hammer, then eventually it figures out it needs a spring, then eventually it figures out it needs a platform. If that was a cell, it would be dead and useless for the entire time leading up to the point where it gets to be complex. Does that make sense? He says it just doesn't add up. How do you get this complexity? It's almost like as if it was design. Oh, no, don't say design. We have to go to the evolutionary process, Francis Crick says. Moving on, the fossil record, I already mentioned, was called the Cambrian Explosion. It does not point to Darwinism. It points to all the sudden species creation. The fossil record is a fact that backs up creation. The fine-tuning of the universe constants, the location of the Earth in relation to the sun. I mean, think about how sensitive we are to temperature. You go just a little bit closer to the sun at the equator, it's freaking hot. You just go a little bit further away, and I'm as far away as I possibly ever want to live. It's freezing cold. Some people, I watched a friend of mine who's up in Green Bay, Wisconsin. They were doing their Easter egg hunt in snow. In snow, people. Come on. Moving on. So we're very sensitive to our temperature. The axis of the Earth is very unique. It gives us our seasons. You've got the moon, which gives us our tides, which regulates the flow of the oceans and everything that lives within the oceans. I mean, all of these constants that are available in nature, plus gravitational constants and biological constants, the way that carbon interacts with other elements, all of these things are so finely tuned and so precise that if any one of them was just slightly off, life doesn't exist. It's a joke when you hear people talk about, we're looking for evidence of life throughout the universe. You ever watch the Discovery Channel when they talk about the planet Earth? They say, Earth, the lucky planet. Well put, ma'am, well put. Martin Rees says, the possibility of life as we know it depends on a few basic physical constants, and in some respects are remarkably sensitive to their numeric values. So nature does exhibit remarkable coincidences. Oh, coincidences. Yeah, like that I love you thing on the beach was just a remarkable coincidence. You start off thinking I was absolutely absurd in saying that, didn't you? That showing up on the beach is far more likely than life existing. And to call it a remarkable coincidence is far more ridiculous than saying that a natural consequence produced I love you inside of a heart on Sandbridge Beach on its own without an outside agent acting upon it. Freeman Dyson says, as we look at the universe and its an identity, many of the ancient physics and astronomy have worked together to our benefit. It almost seems as if the universe must have had some sense in knowing that we were coming. Almost would think that, wouldn't it? Paul Davies, there is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The next thing is the informational proof of DNA. When Carl Sagan set out with the SETI project, the idea was if we're going to listen to all the information we receive from outer space, and if anything we receive from outer space has the appearance of information, we would then conclude that there might be some intelligent life out there that produced that information, because natural occurrences do not produce information. Only intelligence produces information. Interesting you would say that. Can we apply that same theory to DNA? Because DNA is information. Not only is information, it is more complex and more detailed than any human blueprint ever designed, created, or imagined. It works similar to this. If DNA were a book, okay, if you were to take a book, and you could take DNA and you could open up and you could leaf through the instructions. You could also take DNA, drive a hole through any point of it, and you would have a complete sentence giving you another piece of instructions. You could then flip it upside down like this, drive a hole this way, and every letter that it touched would also create a sentence, which would give you another set of instructions. And depending on what protein you make, you just need to keep on flipping it around for it to design whatever kind of protein you would want it to make. You don't think that blows your mind? Come on, seriously, that is absolutely mind-boggling. Could you imagine your instruction manual not just having a section for Spanish, but just literally if you held it in a different angle or flipped it open a different way or just drove a stake through it, that could explain something completely different. That's what DNA can do. That is how complex the information strands are of DNA. And you're going to tell me that just accidentally, biologically, naturalistically happened? Getting a few letters inside of a heart on a beach is a whole lot more likely to have happened naturally than something as complex as DNA. Because that only says one thing when it's read one way, and it's only going to be there for a short time. There was also a study done on mitochondrial DNA. We went through and studied it, and a group of researchers were trying to see, is there a unifying strand of DNA? And they traced it all back to one common ancestor that they believe lived somewhere between 150,000 and 300,000 years ago. Interesting, one common ancestor. You mean not like hundreds of millions of apes all led to humanity, but rather one common ancestor? Where have I heard one common ancestor for humanity before? I don't know. Could it be Genesis? Yeah, I think so. Well, you can imagine what this did to the scientific world. They said, no. This is all pointing towards some sort of biblical creationism. There's got to be a flaw in your thinking. So they commissioned multiple studies to go back and check the research. The researchers came back and they said, well, interestingly enough, we found a few anomalies to the research, a few things we disagree with, a few things we found that shed some light on. Number one is that all these strands seem to point back to three common ancestors sometime before they point back to one common ancestor. Where have I heard that before? Noah had how many sons on the ark? Three. That's quite a coincidence. I don't know. I'm just going to throw that out there. It's just kind of interesting the way those things kind of line up in Genesis. But then moving on, they said, you know, there's another thing. We don't think it was 150 to 300,000 years ago. It was probably 75,000 years ago or less. What? We're getting really close to biblical creationism here with this scientific research that is fact-based. No. Remember, we throw out everything that moves and points in that direction. If it doesn't point to evolution, we have to throw it out because therefore it is not scientific by our terms. Moving on, what else proves or points towards origins of the species coming from a creative God? Issues of love, morality, justice, sense of right and wrong. Those do not come from natural processes. As a matter of fact, natural selection should weed those out. If you want to go to where natural selection leads, it leads to Hitler's regime. He based most of what he was doing in the idea of natural selection, the survival of the fittest. I am the imperial race, and therefore it is my duty for the sake of humanity to eliminate all other feeble-minded, feeble, weak races that don't look like me and don't act like me. That darn Jesse Owens, what is he doing to my whole concept of this? Remember the Olympics was going to show off the power of the Aryan race? And the old Jesse Owens just, nah, moving on. Erwin Schroeder says this, I'm very astonished of the scientific picture of the real world around me, which is very deficient. It gives a lot of factual information, which I kind of laugh at as I read it now, and puts all of our experience in a magnificently consistent order, but it is ghastly silent about all the sundry that really is near the heart, the matters that really are important to us. It cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. It knows nothing of beauty, of good or of ugly or of bad, of God or of eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are often very silly that we're not inclined to take any of them seriously. I agree. And then lastly, the ancient book of the Bible. It's just uncanny how this book written thousands and thousands of years ago so perfectly is lining up with modern scientific thought, even if they don't want you to know it or realize it or believe it or understand it. How is that all a coincidence? That there always was a creation, that something was created out of nothing, that it all traces back to one ancestor. You continue, you go on and on and on. To me, that is a remarkable coincidence. To me, that's evidentiary proof pointing to a fact. What only remains now is the question of time. In the creative account, the only question that remains now is an issue of time, because in Genesis, we all know, it says a 6 days creation, and God rests on the seventh day. And how does all that happen if what we see seems to have taken at least a amount of time? It may not have taken millions and billions of years, but also didn't seem like it happened in 6 days. Well, where do we go with this? I've always grown up believing in a 6 days creation, and I'm still kind of around that realm. However, there is some literary evidentiary proof that would point in a different direction. I'm just going to give you two pieces of it. One is Genesis chapter 2, verses 4, uses the word day in a very different context or way than Genesis 1 uses it. And it's funny, only the King James Version actually uses the actual translative, literal translation from the Hebrew. All the other translations, for some reason, and I'm wondering if maybe there was a spiritual bias on this, get rid of the word day in there as to not confuse you from a 6 days literal creation. It says this in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the heavens and the earth. You see, if you just take that, you have a one-day creation, if you take that literal, do you not? In chapter 1, you have a 6 days creation. Chapter 2, you now have a one-day creation. So maybe there's something here we have to figure out in this word day. There's also something else I find very peculiar. In Genesis chapter 1, at the end of each day, from days 1 to 6, how do those verses end? And there was morning and evening, day 1. Morning and evening, day 2. Morning and evening, day 3. Morning and evening, day 4. 3, morning and evening, day 4. Morning and evening, day 5. Morning and evening, day 6. I'm going to read you day 7. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array, and by the seventh day God had finished the work that he had been doing. So on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because he had rested on it from all the work that he was creating, and he said, it is done. What's missing? There was morning and evening, day 7. It's interesting the way that is missing. The reason why that is very interesting is if you flip over to the book of Hebrews, chapter 4, you'll find a very interesting verse in there. Now, I happen to know Hebrews 4 pretty well because I was taking both a class in Joshua and a class in Hebrews at the exact same time. And I noticed that there was a passage in the book of Hebrews that was quoting a passage from the book of Joshua, and I figured out if I write a paper on this topic, I can write one paper for two classes. So I happened to study this while I was in seminary. And it says this, now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God has said. So I declared in an oath in my anger that they shall never enter my rest. And yet his works have been finished since the creation of the world. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, On the seventh day, God rested from all his work. And again, the passage above, he says, they shall never enter my rest. Therefore, since it still remains that some enter that rest, and since those who formerly had the good news proclaimed to them did not go in because of their disobedience, God again set a certain day, calling it today. This he did when a long time ago he spoke through his prophet David, the passage already quoted, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for God's people. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from their works, just as God did from him, from his. Therefore, let us make every effort to enter that rest so that no one will perish by following their example of disobedience. Now, I don't have enough time to explain this fully, but did you at least connect a connection between the seventh day of rest that at least makes some appearance or allusion to the fact that this seventh day of rest is something that is continuing on right now, that we are living in the seventh day of God's rest, and that God's hope for all of eternity or for all of humanity is that we would enter and join him in this rest, and that through disobedience and denying the good news that we've been presented, we would forfeit the ability to enter into his rest? Could it be that since the creation of the world, he is now in the seventh day? And what does that then say about the first 6 days? Oh, I'm out of time.
But we're in the last service.
Oh, you're right, but we are already so far over. Thank you for being patient with me, letting me move through all that material and information. So what does that point to? I don't think it gives you the constraint of a literal 6 days. I think it allows for some leeway. I still don't believe in billions upon billions of years, especially if the reason why you're going to say there's billions of years is simply because you have an evolutionary framework that requires time to be your hero. I don't care what your hero is. I care what the evidence points to. And the Cambrian explosion points to what's happening all of a sudden. I think it's very possible it's in the realm of thousands of years or tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, maybe at the most. But I'm not buying into the millions and billions and trillions type of theory. And I think the biblical text literally, linguistically allows for that. Also, if you read the other text in there, it begins to shed even more light on it that it doesn't give you those same constraints. Now, I'm not saying that as a heretic. I'm saying that as somebody who's studying the Bible and reading what it actually says, not what I just literally want it to say to fit a preconceived notion of what my pastor growing up told me. So with that, let's close in prayer. Father, I think there is far more evidence that points to intelligent design. And Father, what I read in your word is not just that there was an intelligent design, but that there was a loving creation. And that we are the result not just of your intelligence, but of your love and of your thought. For so much of the universe, as the science says, almost seems as though it was expecting us, that it was created for us. As we read in your word, it was created as a gift to us to enjoy. So Father, may we look to you for our origins, to understand who we are and why we're here. And in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.